I'm Claire Wiley.
And I'm Seth Arnes.
And this morning we are continuing our conversation on the potential environmental impacts of the proposed Box Elder County Stratus Project. Our next guest is ecologist professor and executive director of Grow the Flow, Ben Abbott. Ben, thank you so much for joining us today on This Green Earth.
Thank you for having me.
Now, Ben, many people might recognize your name, actually, because you were in a recent film, The Lake, and that premiered right here in Park City at Sundance. And the topic, of course, was the Great Salt Lake and the strains it is under. So we are familiar in this state about the fragility of the Great Salt Lake Basin and our current water concerns. These have garnered a fair bit of attention, and these concerns preceded and were independent of this proposed data center. So let's begin the conversation. We ask the questions here generally, but what is the number one question that you are raising about this project?
You know, it's interesting. The developers are claiming that the impact on water consumption will be very minor. And that could be true, right? We haven't seen the full proposal. That's one of the issues. But I think the most direct connection with Great Salt Lake is actually much more on the government process side, right? How do we decide to do big projects? How are we going to change the landscape of water use and energy use in the watershed? And the concern that I've seen that really has unified Utahns across the political spectrum is, why is a major mega project like this being pushed through so quickly without input from the public? And so that process question is crucial, because we're going to have to save Great Salt Lake, we need to conserve around 1 million acre feet of water every year and then deliver it to the lake. So that's going to take a lot of change to our environmental policies and practices. So we need to have transparency, public participation, and a high level of ethics and integrity in government.
While we don't quite understand the full impacts of water use on this particular data center, water use within data center projects is certainly a concern. What do we know about how this project will impact water use and water supply within the Great Salt Lake watershed?
You know, there are two things that I'd point out. I am on the record as somebody who has pointed out over and over again, data centers currently represent a fraction of 1% of our water use in the Great Salt Lake watershed. People get very alarmed about them because they are a new, you know, a novel use of water. And as we see the lake decline, we think, okay, what has changed? But we need to keep our eye on the ball here. Currently, the largest water user by far, that accounts for 2/3 of the water consumption, is agriculture. Cities are a close second, right? They just about round out the rest. So currently, data centers are not a major user of water in our region. This project, on the other hand, is so large that it absolutely could impact our water use and our ability to restore Great Salt Lake. And the developers are claiming that they're going to use a dry cooling method to produce the power and then a closed loop to cool the servers on this project. If you do both of those things, then that there is a pathway forward where data centers could use a very little amount of water. My concern is we don't have commitments about that yet. And even at this, you know, if we think about 9 gigawatts of electricity production, currently that's twice the amount of electricity being produced in the entire state. And that would be concentrated right on the north shore of Great Salt Lake. So that's where these questions come up. Is this data center actually going to be a step toward responsible water use and a demonstrator of how we can meet our computational needs without consuming a large amount of water? Or is it likely to start using more and more water as we've seen with other power generation projects?
So one of the biggest concerns it sounds like you're raising is perhaps transparency in the plan. Given what's at stake, what answers could be provided that you would see as satisfactory to move forward?
Look, I am a huge proponent of technological innovation, you know, to solve the great environmental problems of our day, loss of human life to environmental pollution, the decline of life on Earth, loss of biodiversity, and climate change, we need to innovate, right? We need to do things differently. So if this company can come in and say, here is laying out the technologies, here's how we're going to achieve it, making the economic case, and then really importantly, making a legal commitment to that, right? That's a very different proposition. If we've got clarity of how they're going to mitigate the environmental impact of the project, then there really could be a path forward. But right now, we don't have those assurances. And a few years ago, there was this controversy over Utah Lake, right, where outside developers wanted to build the world's largest artificial islands and put 500,000 people out on the lake. That was a non-starter because we didn't have legal protections, right, to assure the people of Utah our water supply, our food security, our quality of life aren't going to be impacted by this project. We need those legal assurances now. If it's a situation where we have developers and government officials saying, just trust us, it's going to work out fine, that's not how we want to be making these major decisions about the future of our state.
We keep hearing the term closed loop, a closed loop system. What does that mean, and is this something that's achievable?
Yeah, there actually already are examples here in the watershed of data centers that don't consume water for their cooling. Now, if we go back in time, the last generation data centers like the NSA data center here in Utah County, they evaporated water to cool their computers, their servers. When water evaporates, it absorbs a huge amount of heat. And so that's a very efficient way to get rid of heat without increasing local temperatures. Now, the current generation of server cooling technologies are either pass-through systems where you use the water as a heat sink, but then you don't actually evaporate the water. You return it to the wastewater treatment plant where it can re-enter the lake or the river. Or some of them actually are closed loop, meaning that they circulate water to take heat away from the servers, and then they emit it to the atmosphere. That is a great way to conserve water, but there's a trade-off. That heat has to go somewhere, right? One of our ecological laws is there is no away. You don't throw things away, things go someplace. Mm-hmm. And so if you're not going to dissipate the heat by evaporating water, that means that you have to put the heat somewhere. And in this case, they're saying that they're going to do it into the atmosphere. And for a typical data center that is maybe a couple hundred megawatts, that usually doesn't have an enormous local impact. For something that is slated to be 9 gigawatts, all of a sudden that becomes really, really problematic. And in fact, you kind of have two pathways here. Either you generate a huge amount of local heat, or you consume a large amount of water. Those are the two ways to deal with this heat dissipation problem. So it's absolutely attainable to have a closed loop system. We have examples of that here locally, but there's this trade-off for a facility this large. The estimates out of Utah State indicate that we could have substantial increases, 2 to 5 degrees warmer temperatures during the day, and 8 to 28 degrees warmer temperatures at night. And that's the difference between Utah's semi-arid environment and the Sahara Desert in North Africa, right? Those are really, really substantial changes in temperature that we need to take seriously. And that's where we need clear answers from these developers. What trade-offs are you willing to accept? Because if they're just telling us we're going to use next-gen technology to have no impact, that's contrary to the laws of physics.
I'm glad you brought up the aspect of what to do with this additional heat energy that's created from the data centers. And it looks like in this case, it is going to be a closed loop system. That heat's going to be dissipated with large fans, that heat will be transferred to the local environment. From your perspective as an ecologist, what are some of the impacts that you might see from both the temperature increases during the day and the potential for much larger temperature increases at night?
You know, the local environmental impacts of a mega project like this are very, very large. Taking a step back, even before we talk about the heat, a 40,000 acre campus in a valley which currently is largely intact sage land ecosystem, That is a huge chunk of Utah's wilderness that will be lost. And that habitat is really important to everything from pronghorn antelope and mule deer to sage grouse and birds that are migrating through that region. So first, let's put into context a 40,000-acre campus. This is the size of Bryce Canyon National Park, right? A really big chunk of Utah's land going to a single use. Then you add on top of that the roads that are going to intersect and interfere with migration of the deer, antelope, elk, and other wildlife that are out there. And you're talking about a real change from what is currently one of the most remote and intact ecosystems in the state into what would be an enormous industrial complex. So we start with that. Then if you add on top of it, I want to be totally clear. When I first heard that these data centers have a large impact on the thermal regime of the ecosystem around them, I was skeptical. It's very hard. It takes a huge amount of energy to change the temperature of the atmosphere or ground. And typically, if you're talking about a power plant or a server farm, it doesn't have a huge local thermal impact. But then I looked at the data, and if you're talking about 9 gigawatts of usable electricity, that requires around 16 gigawatts of input of thermal energy. That's because the gas plant that they're proposing is very inefficient, right? You only get about half of that energy back as electricity. And so that 16 gigawatts of energy has to be dissipated. That could affect precipitation in the valley and in surrounding valleys. That could affect large-scale airflow. If we're talking about the dew point here, right? A lot of these desert ecosystems depend on the nighttime air temperature getting cold enough that you have condensation. That's what creates soil moisture for plants to grow. That's what allows insects, reptiles to actually drink, right? They will use that condensation as a tool for meeting their needs to be able to drink and access water. And so we would basically be talking about completely changing the biome of this region from a high-altitude, semi-arid sagebrush steppe to something that would be much more similar to the Mojave or even Sahara deserts. So an absolute change in the local environmental conditions that currently allow for this beautiful mix of farming and natural environment to coexist.
Now, thinking about some of those impacts, I want to try and get an idea of what you think the scale of those impacts. We're ultimately talking about local impacts in this Hansel Valley and on this 40,000-acre campus. But can you give us a little idea of the scale that we're talking about when we say local impacts?
Yeah, I just want to say we use a principle that's called the precautionary principle in ecology. So if somebody comes in and has a proposal to build a dam, to build a power plant, to use a new chemical in manufacturing or in the food supply, the burden of proof is on the developer to demonstrate that that's not going to cause harm, right? That burden of proof shouldn't be on the public or on independent researchers to prove that there's going to be a negative impact, right? That groundwork needs to be done by the people that are going to potentially benefit from the project. And so I just want to make sure that that's really clear here, because we are in the realm of speculation. We don't have the data. We don't know all of the specs for this plant, either on the power generation side or on the server farm side. So we are engaged in a thought experiment where we're saying, what are the potential impacts? You know, what are the hypothetical changes to the environment that we see? And the answer there is a plausible chance that this could affect large-scale weather patterns for the northern part of Utah and the southern part of Idaho, right? When you talk about adding 16 gigawatts of thermal energy to the environment, this is really, really significant. And you know, the places that rain and snowfall depend on atmospheric circulation. And so you start disrupting those thermals that are going in the day, you start disrupting the temperature inversions that set up at night, you absolutely could be in a scenario where we see changes that are affecting farmers, ranchers, and cities throughout the whole region. So we're not just talking about the 40,000 acres. Now, I'm not saying that those impacts are likely, but they are possible. And that means that it is on the developers to run those meteorological and climate models to understand the full impact of what they are proposing. And, you know, we've seen several elected officials and even the developers themselves really backpedaling on some of the claims on the size of this and on where the energy is going to come from. And that's fine and good. But we need clarity to understand what they are proposing so that we can independently check what might be impacted here. We haven't started to even discuss the air pollution impacts. Remember, we now know because of 50 years of focused research from public health and medical professionals that one of the most deadly things going on in the world right now that's affecting our health and flourishing is air pollution. Air pollution affects every system in the human body at every stage of development, from prenatal till gerontological care, right, end-of-life care. We need to understand how much pollution is going to be produced, where is it going to go, right? There's a real difference in where that pollution travels during the day and at night. How much is this going to impact downwind communities along the Wasatch Front? How much is this going to impact wildlife and rural communities that are closer to the project site? We need to have answers to this. And we've got an example just recently, U.S. Magnesium, one of the largest polluters in the Western United States, has been shut down, you know, thanks to leadership on both the state side and private sector side, right? The water rights from U.S. Magnesium have now been taken and permanently dedicated to help the recovery of Great Salt Lake. That one industrial polluter was responsible at times for 10 to 20% of the pollution being experienced along the Wasatch Front, right? We need to make sure that we don't replace that serious environmental polluter from U.S. Magnesium with a new one, right? This Stratos project. And there have been people that have said, don't worry about these impacts. You've got NEPA, you've got the federal government that's going to protect you. But those tools are very slow. And let's be clear, right? In Utah, we don't like that kind of federal regulation. The Clean Air Act wasn't ultimately the reason that U.S. Magnesium shut down. Right? It was because local people got organized, local leaders exercised leadership, and made choices to protect the people of Utah. So we need to be consistent here on how we're going to evaluate whether this is the right project for us, and who is responsible ultimately for potential negative impacts that come from it. Are we going to outsource our leadership to the federal government? That does not make sense to me.
You had mentioned the habitat and wildlife loss and migratory birds, which are clearly something that we have already flagged as potentially changing their patterns, or things are happening because of the Great Salt Lake in the state that it is in now. So I know it's hard to tell what those ripple effects will be, but just in the case of wildlife and those migratory birds, what are some of the things that we could experience that would ripple out well past our area of the nation?
So Great Salt Lake is mostly gone, right? Two-thirds of its water is gone. More than half of its area is gone because of upstream water use. And Great Salt Lake supports more than half of our state's wetlands. Those wetlands are crucial to 10 to 12 million migratory birds every year. That's a fifth of the shorebirds in the entire hemisphere. Birds travel to this region from every state in the country and every country in the Western Hemisphere. And so if we protect and restore this habitat, that the positive effects are going to ripple out. Right, we will see increased resiliency and life throughout the entire hemisphere. I did my PhD up in northern Alaska at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. I didn't know at that time that the tundra swans that we would see that would actually come and mess with our scientific equipment, in some years, Over 70% of their global population congregates at Great Salt Lake, right? They travel thousands of miles here because this habitat is so important. These ecosystems are so productive. And the north arm of Great Salt Lake, almost half of the lake's area is already dead because of the Union Pacific Causeway that's concentrated salts in that that half of the lake. But there still are intact and functioning wetlands up there near the Hansel Valley. And so this project, if it does affect weather patterns, day and nighttime temperatures, could affect those wetlands and remove that keystone habitat in ways that we haven't yet even begun to discuss or anticipate, right? So again, thinking to the precautionary principle, this region is so important, not just to the people of Utah, but to the biosphere integrity of the Western Hemisphere. We have to ensure that we're not threatening that. And I've been extremely encouraged over the last few months. You know, we have seen the governor, the Senate president, the Speaker of the House make an unparalleled commitment, right? They have publicly committed to restore Great Salt Lake by 2034. When the world comes to Utah for the 2034 Olympic and Paralympic Games, we are going to be able to tell the world one of the most important success stories environmentally of this century. You know, that we turned around the decline of the largest saline lake in the Western Hemisphere. We need to be able to tell that story, not just for our state pride, but to ensure that this region remains habitable. We need to be laser focused on that goal and ensure that no project, no industrial project, no urban or residential project, no agricultural project imperils progress on that goal. So we need to protect these wetlands locally near the Hansel Valley. We need to restore Great Salt Lake as a whole.
Can those two exist? Can the data center and that goal exist?
We don't have the data to make a conclusion on that yet. There is a pathway. If you powered this data center with renewable energy, if you had a closed loop system that was thinking about where to move that heat, imagine if instead of just using that as waste heat, you used the large thermal gradients created by this plant to generate secondary electricity, right? There are lots of creative, innovative things that we could do to demonstrate that you don't have to create a sacrifice zone to meet our national security and economic goals. I believe there's a path toward that. So maybe this is going to be controversial, but I'll say I don't think that data centers in Great Salt Lake are incompatible. But to walk that line, to make sure that we're not talking about trade-offs, we need to have cooperative and transparent planning. Right? We need to make sure that the developers aren't just looking to make a buck and then cash out, but actually that this meets the data needs that we have and also is a source of environmental resilience. You know, I've heard a case from some that say, look, the revenues from this project are going to be very helpful in paying farmers, right, to conserve water, in helping cities transition to water-wise landscapes. And that could be the case. But only if we have commitments and if we have the policies in place to ensure that revenues from the project are flowing back into conservation. And so the answer for me right now would be I am very skeptical that this project is going to be helpful. And I think that the people of Utah should be skeptical. We deserve to be convinced, right? Rather than just informed that this project is moving forward.
We have been speaking with ecologist, professor, and executive director of Grow the Flow, Ben Abbott. Ben, if people want to learn more about this project or if you have any information that's available for them on the web, where would they go?
If you go to growtheflowutah.org, that'll pull up the latest information, not only on this project, but other opportunities to conserve water and help restore Great Salt Lake. I actually do think that the discussion going on around this project is incredibly constructive. We have seen Utahns literally from every walk of life join together. That meeting up in Box Elder County with the county commissioners, I understand it was acrimonious, but I actually thought that it was a moment of beautiful unity where we saw ranchers, farmers, city folk, environmentalists, even data center developers come together and say, we need to do this better. And long-term ecological conservation and ultimately creating a sustainable civilization, that doesn't come from environmental policies. It comes from widely held environmental values. When the people of a region say, we are going to protect, we are going to be good stewards of this glorious creation that we are part of. And so I'm really hopeful that this proposal galvanizes a new level of coordination. That's what we're trying to do at Grow the Flow, as well as the many other wonderful organizations that are engaged on this issue.
Thank you again for joining us on This Green Earth.
Oh, thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to This Green Earth.
If you have an idea, we'd love to hear from you. Give us your ideas and topics, your storylines. It's thisgreenearth@kpcw.org.
You can also find us wherever you listen to your podcast. If you like the show and you learned something new, make sure you leave a review. And we'd appreciate it if you click 5 stars.